I know how intimidating beekeeping can be, especially in those first couple of years, and not knowing what you need, what to do, or where to find help can be downright scary. That's why I created the AI-assisted Beekeeping for Newbies mobile app to be right there with you as you start your beekeeping journey. Loaded up with checklists, guides, and one of my favorites, a bunch of queen bee photos to help you get better at locating them during inspections. I created this app to provide you with a single source to help jumpstart your learning and make you a better beekeeper. Go to studio.com/beekeeper. That's studio.com/beekeeper to get started today. Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Well, by the time you are hearing this episode, the Beekeeping for Newbies app has officially launched. The link is in the description, so go check that out. Last week, we wrapped up Varroa Week. And as promised early in the week there, we are addressing the topics that were submitted for further elaboration. So today we're going to be honoring the two members of our listening audience who took us up on that offer. And I most certainly appreciate both of them for submitting these suggestions. But first, let's talk about this weekend's hive inspection. We have a hive report for colony number 6-1. The outside temp was 66 Fahrenheit, just under 19 degrees Celsius. Winds were 10 to 15 miles per hour, and it was partly sunny or partly cloudy, depending on whether or not you're an optimist or a pessimist. This is a four-frame nuke with an Italian queen. Now, when I opened the nuke up, let me go back. So this was, I think, the very first, maybe second colony that I installed from the package. When I opened it up, the first thing I notice is, of course, the frame feeder is still in there, which is kind of not cool for a colony that has been around for over 3 weeks now and is in a four-frame nuke. They really need some space. But I saw the frame feeder. I thought, okay, no problem. We're going to get that out. And then I looked on the side of the feeder and realized that they had also drawn comb entirely down the side of the feeder, and it was loaded with brood, so I decided that we are not going to be removing the feeder just yet. So I took a quick peek at the remaining frames. The other three frames were completely packed. There was about maybe a half of the outer frame that still had a little bit of space left, but this thing was wall-to-wall capped brood, and it was about to become a nuke explosion. So I grabbed some plywood. I grabbed some of the 3/4 inch by 3/4 inch 2x4s that I had ripped down that I would then be using for my edges and the back to support a bottom board. I made a 5-frame nuke bottom board. I grabbed 2 5-frame nukes and I prepped 6 frames of plastic foundation on a wooden frame. And I did the old surfboard style waxing to get those all waxed up and ready to go. And I took the 6 frames, the 2 hive bodies, the homemade bottom board, and then I also cut a custom inner cover from canvas, took all that stuff over to the bee yard. I went up to the 4-frame nuke and I marked where the entrance was on the ground just so I could kind of line it up as close as possible. And then I pushed that nuke about 8 inches to my left. I set the new 5-frame nuke bottom board right there in that spot, lined up the entrance of the nuke with where I had marked it. And then I put the 5-frame nuke hive body onto the new bottom board that I had created. And it was loaded with 2 frames. So I put 2 frames of just the regular, like I said, wooden frames with plastic foundation that was all prepped up. And I put, correction, I put 3 of those in there. So I now had 3 frames with 2 available spaces. I took 2 frames of brood from the 4-frame nuke, put them into the bottom. So now in the bottom, I've got a frame of prepped foundation, a 2nd frame of prepped foundation, 2 brood frames, and then another frame of prepped foundation. I put the 2nd hive body on top. On the far side of one edge, either position 1 or 5, whichever you prefer to call it, that's where I put the feeder. I put an additional frame of brood in that center spot, and then I put 2 frames of plastic foundation in a wooden frame on either side of the brood box. So now we have 2 brood frames down below, 1 brood frame up above, and we have a whole lot of brood getting ready to emerge. I went out today. The temperature, I think, was right around like 60 Fahrenheit, and there were bees everywhere, tons of orientation flights. So a lot of bees are now stepping out of the hive and getting ready to start become foragers. And that clearly tells me that we have a new influx of emerging worker brood. So that was pretty exciting. The timing is pretty good. I did not see any queen cells, which was good. It would not have surprised me, though, because I really left them a little bit too long. And I do still have one more five-frame nuke in there that needs to be expanded. I have a second five-frame nuke box ready to go. I just need to prep a few frames, and that one will be good to go. A little note, I want to pass along a little tip here. I don't know if I should call it a tip or if I should just call it negligence that I found a workaround for, but I had stacked, you know, the hive bodies together when I was moving them from point A to point B. But part of what I talk about a lot is prepping your gear, prepping your equipment, making sure everything is ready. It's not just physically doing something to one piece of equipment. For example, if you plan to run two deeps, queen excluder, and a medium with an inner cover and an outer cover, put it all together and look at how everything fits together. I'm saying this for a very specific reason. These nuke boxes have been in my garden shed for a few years. I haven't used them in at least 4 years, probably. I took them out. I walked over to the bee yard where my bees are, set everything down, put them together, and I was about to walk away. And I noticed that where the fronts of them and the sideboards aligned, the front panel was a little bit higher on the bottom one. And what this caused was the side, of course, would then be lower, and it made a gap. And it was a very substantial gap that is running along the entire left and right side of that nuke hive body. And there was nothing I could do. I got them completely packed back in, and I can't go back and now just start over. And even if I wanted to, I'm out of gear. I don't have extra hive bodies here with bottom boards and 8-frame, 10-frame configurations that I can just put out there and say, okay, we'll just use this. I still have to make that trip to storage that I've been delaying. And as I was wrapping all of this up, I recognized that it was supposed to rain later on that evening. So I went ahead and took a roll of regular masking tape. It was a black masking tape. And I went all the way around the entire perimeter where both of the two hive bodies joined and just made sure that I sealed it up. Yes, the bees can absolutely propolize those things shut, but that was a really big crack all the way around. It's going to take a lot of resources and a lot of time to fix that. So what I'm going to end up doing is right now it's just covered so that bugs, ants, hive beetles, small roaches, whatever, can't slide through there and get in and cause any kind of trouble at all. Once I bring in some 10-frame hardware, I'll just upgrade them to a 10-frame box, but I'm going to have to actually sand those things down. I'm probably going to put them on like a belt sander or some kind of a sander to make those edges nice and smooth so that they sit flush again. And that was kind of a bad thing for me. Again, it goes back to making sure you're prepping all your gear, as I did not. The last remaining item to take care of, I mentioned I had the inner cover that I've cut fresh, a brand new canvas inner cover. I took the old 4-frame migratory cover and I just kind of flipped it upside down on top to keep the weight down on the inner cover to make sure that it can't blow away or anything. The bees will propolize it down over the next couple of days. And I do need to make about a 1-inch wider migratory cover. So I flipped it upside down so that it would trigger my mind that this is obviously wrong. So if I walk out and I see and I go, why is that upside down? Oh, that's right. It's the wrong size. I need to make another one. And it's 10 or 15 minutes worth of work. So it's not a big deal. It just needs to get done. Okay, so today we're going to cover the two listener requests from last week. The first one on the list, and it was actually brought up in the Discord room today as well, but it is about a bear fence or bear fences. So if you are living in bear country or an area where you suspect that bears may traverse your area, this is kind of not really going to be an optional thing because a bear will destroy, dismantle, and disrupt all activity within your apiary in a matter of minutes. They can come through and be incredibly destructive all over the place. And if you don't do anything about it, you come out the next day and you try to clean things up and make it better, they'll come back the next night, a couple nights later. They'll keep coming back, and they will just go until everything is completely destroyed. So you're going to need to make sure that you are looking at a proper electric fence setup. I mean, that's really your only defense. Please don't shoot the bear just because it's coming through there trying to get something to eat. It's just trying to survive. Now, if you're on the fence and you're like, I'm not really sure if we need one where I am, ask around, ask your neighbors, talk to different people, people in the bee club, people who may have some kind of indicator as to what's going on. When I first established the apiary down at the property years ago, within the first 2 weeks, I think, I had lost a bunch of colonies. And I thought, oh, man, there's a bear down here. I talked to a neighbor and he says, oh, yeah, there's a big, you know, big old mama bear who comes through here. And I didn't realize that. I didn't expect it to be an issue in that area. And subsequently, I installed a fence and I haven't had a problem since. I still have not seen any there, but it's definitely something you're going to have to keep in mind and possibly do. So here is what you're going to need. Now, the method I'm going to tell you here, and I'll give a couple different tips and tricks and things, but don't take this as an all-inclusive list or the only way of doing things. This is just kind of a high-level list of things you're probably going to need. This will vary a little bit depending on exactly the approach you take and everything. But the key kind of components are you're going to need a charger, the actual fence charger that puts out the electricity. So that's kind of piece number one. You're going to have a good solid way to secure that. So a lot of people will put a 4x4 post in the ground fairly close to the fence and mount it to that post so that they can kind of reach over, switch it off, and then be able to gain access to the fence. Other people will have the on-off switch further inside to make sure that a person can't come and turn it off and access your area. That's kind of a separate thing, but there are specialized handles that you can get where you can unhook the fence or a gate and open it up and then go inside and turn it off. But just be thinking about everything as a holistic entire solution before you start doing things, because once you kind of go down the path of start putting things together, your options become a little bit limited. So for starters, on the charger, you're going to want to be looking at 1 joule or higher. Now, some people, places, entities have said 0.7 joules or higher is fine. What I did was I picked up the phone. I called a company in Montana about 7 years ago, and I said, hey, this is what I'm looking to do. What do you recommend? And they said, you can get away with a lot less for a bear that you're just trying to keep out of your campsite or something like that. When it is a food-motivated bear, you want to be at 1 joule or greater. So that's what I've gone with as long as I've been doing bear fences and setting things up. So the charger is part number one. Now, the way that this is ultimately going to end up working is that the fence itself is receiving that electrical charge and is your positive wire all the way around. The ground is your negative wire. And then when you are touching the wire while your feet are on the ground, you are now the conductor of the electricity. Same thing with the bear or any other animal that might want to get inside and start harassing your bees. So the number one thing that has to happen once you get your charger mounted wherever you're going to mount it is you're going to need to put a ground rod into the ground. I recommend putting it down pretty deep, go at least 6 feet or so. And if you have really dry conditions or periods of drought, you know, pour a gallon of water down the ground rod every now and then just to keep it wet. You may also want to consider putting 2 or 3 of them out at about 10 feet apart from one another, starting near the charger. So if you have the charger is mounted on the post, right next to the post, put your ground rod in, go 10 feet one way and put another one, go 10 feet the other way, put another one, and then connect the 3 of them with the lugs, the grounding lugs, and you want to use an insulated wire. That way, in case anything that happens to be hot for whatever reason contacts it, you don't end up shorting it out or causing an issue. Now, the next part to that then is the electricity that's going to move through the fence on the positive side of the wire. Now, as far as the wire that you're going to choose, you're going to kind of have 2 basic options. You'll have like a poly wire, which is kind of like it's almost like a string, but inside the string, it's got a wire. And that wire ends up being the conductive piece that anything that makes contact with it will then become shocked. I prefer the solid wire. That's what I use. It conducts really well. And I've had a couple of instances, not with something not shocking on the poly, but where you have to jump the lines. Like if you put 3 or 4 rows, one of them is going to be down maybe 4 or 5 inches off the ground. Another one might be 8 to 12 inches or so above that one. You know, you kind of have to space them out based on what makes sense with your configuration, how much wire you have. But you do need to make sure that you jump them electrically from the top row to the top middle to the bottom middle to the bottom. And I've had issues with some of the clamps and that jumping wire not connecting really well when you're using the poly wire. But again, as long as you're making that connection, that's fine. Also, while I'm on that subject, don't forget to get yourself a voltage checker or a electric fence tester. It has a little hook on it, and you can hook it around the wire, and then it'll tell you how many volts are running through that line so you can know whether or not it is actively charged or not. But again, make sure if you're using that poly wire that you are hooking that thing onto a metal piece. If it doesn't make contact with that metal wire, it'll say zero, and you'll know pretty quickly that that was not actually accurate. It will let you know. Now, when you're putting these around, they're going to end up hooking into an insulator, and the insulator connects onto a T-post. And these T-posts get driven into the ground. And again, how big of a T-post or how long of one you need will depend on where you are and how deep you have to go into the ground and all of that. You may have like a 6-foot T-post that you put 2 feet into the ground and it's only 4 feet, you know, 4 feet high. That may be perfectly fine where you are. But between the post and the wire, whichever wire type you use, you're going to have an insulator. And of course, that insulator, just piece of plastic that makes sure that you don't have metal touching metal, which would then, of course, ground it out. Now, if you're buying I'm kind of a little bit all over the map because I'm trying to remember all these things off the top of my head. But one thing that you'll notice when you buy a fence charger, they usually rate them in miles, like a 7 mile, 2 mile, 5 mile, 20 mile. When you're looking at that number, make sure you're thinking of all strands together because it has to push electricity down every one of those lines. So if you had a fence that went 1 mile one way and just kept going 1 mile in each direction, then of course it gets back to you in a square at 4 miles. But if you've got four sets of strands and you're doing four of those, now you have 16 miles. So just be mindful of that when you're looking at the total rated number of miles that these things can span. So again, you know, off the ground, probably like in that 4 to 6 range, you want to make sure you're cutting the grass, keeping the grass well maintained, manicured on the bottom, because once it pushes up underneath of that lower line, that lower strand, it can definitely cause some connectivity and cause a bit of a drain against the battery. You also want to be checking pretty regularly to make sure that no branches or anything else from anywhere has fallen down. And one is making some kind of a connection to the ground, but also something that could be potentially causing an unsafe situation at all. Like if something's making contact to it and it rains and it's wet, and now you have the wet, you know, the moisture could conduct electricity on the top to a person nearby or something. You just walk around periodically, make sure there's not debris or other things, you know, falling down on or around your fence. And of course, if something does happen, you don't do anything about it. Now you're unprotected and the bear gets all the honey. Now, several different entities, places will recommend putting some peanut butter or hanging some bacon from the fence in an effort to attract the bear there. And the idea behind that is if they sniff it with their nose and they put their nose up against that electric fence, that shock to the nose will be much more memorable to them than their paw. Like they might push their paw against it and it hurts a little bit, but they decide to push through. Once they've pushed through once, they're going to go, okay, I can come back later. But part of me kind of feels like if they weren't already there checking things out, now you're going to draw them in. I don't know if that's the best thing to do, but like I said, that's the suggestion that a couple of different professional entities had suggested. So you can take that into consideration as you decide to bait and prepare your electrified fence. Now, the one that I use has a small solar panel mounted to it. It has an internal battery. You probably have to replace it. It's like a lead acid battery. You got to replace it every 3 years or whatever, but it just has a simple on off switch. And it's rated for, I think, 1.1 joules, 6,000 volts, if memory serves me correctly. 6,000 volts, again, is going to be on the minimal on that one, and then targeting 1 joule or higher. Now, I touched on it before, but I just want to highlight this again. The grounding and the ground rods, like, that's a really big thing. That's the most important piece. If the system is not effectively and properly grounded, it will not deliver the shock that it needs to. So, again, make sure the grounds are good. Make sure the jumper wires are connecting you know, top strand or top wire down to each of the middle ones down to the bottom. Keep weeds, grass, everything else free. And that should just about cover it for the bare fence. So the second topic that we had was a multi-topic thing, but we can cover them all pretty quickly here, so that's no problem. But the question was around hive manipulation and, you know, like reversing boxes in the spring, and when do we do that, and do we need to do that, and how do we encourage the drawing of comb? And the other question was selecting frames for a split, or it could be for making a nuke. It's really kind of the same process. So those are all good questions here. So I guess we'll start it from the top with reversing the boxes. Now, if you have never kept bees, or you're new, or you're in your first season now, what's going to end up happening is, let's say you have your single box and they're building everything out and things are going great. And then you throw the second box on and you're thinking, cool, they've got plenty of space. You go on vacation, you come back 2 weeks later, there's swarm cells everywhere. They're about to swarm. They're not even touching the top space. And you're like, what's going on? What happened? And they're kind of not really recognizing that as expansion space. It's kind of a problematic thing. And it's kind of strange because we, as beekeepers, we put things down and then we move and grow upwards. And then when you go to the tree and the cavity, the bees go into the cavity, they start at the top and they draw everything down. So they will work from the top down in the hive. They will consume the honey from the bottom and the sides up, and then they will start back at the top again and work their way back down. And they just up, down throughout the seasons, perfectly normal. Now, we as beekeepers, again, we're always adding at the top. If we wanted to mimic things and make it more like what's in the tree, then you could just add your bee box on the bottom. I did this a few years ago. I just threw one in. I was barely paying attention. I was really, really busy at the time, and I wanted to see how they handled it. I figured, you know, let's just see what they do, if they do anything differently, if they recognize it as expansion space kind of natively, inherently, or if we still had to do some manipulation to make them check it out. And it was one that ended up leaving on a pollination thing about, I think it was like 3 or 4 weeks later, and I didn't get a chance to follow up on it. But I can definitely do that. We'll do that here. I'll make a note after we wrap up here to do that in the apiary this year so we can show you what it looks like firsthand. But as far as reversing the boxes go, a lot of people are like, oh, you got to reverse your boxes every year. You absolutely do not need to reverse your boxes every year. I am unaware of anything, biologically speaking, that you have to gain by reversing the boxes. Now, I can tell you one or two little things that, you know, maybe can help make a case. As the bees are consuming all of these resources and they get up to the top, now you are in a position, or they are in a position, where everything in the bottom's kind of empty and whatever's left of the good stuff is up top, and they're kind of ready to start laying that up and making new brood and, you know, working their way back down. If you've got a queen excluder on still, of course, that's going to create a challenge because the queen is not quite all the way up and everybody else is up higher and they'd rather work up top and they've got things ready, but she doesn't want to go up there. So they're like, why don't you come up here? And then they have an argument. It's a whole long mess that they get into. But the second piece of that is you've got an entire box down below that is not being used. It doesn't have any need at that point in time. So the idea of maybe removing the bottom box, giving them a smaller cavity towards the end of the winter, early spring, a smaller cavity to maintain, I can see where that makes a lot of sense. Reversing them, again, I've done it several times, and I like doing it because now I can reverse it. If I want to go to a single brood box config, I just slap a queen excluder on top. I make sure all the brood's in the bottom first, of course, and then I can do whatever I want to do from there. Or if I decide I want to pull that top box off for a while, or I want to take the top box off, backfill it with wax foundation on new frames, and use all those frames of drawn comb for splits or for nukes or for something else, there are reasons that removing or pulling those can have some benefit and make a lot of sense. But just as a practice of like, oh yeah, it's spring, I've got to reverse these, I have not heard a case yet where I've thought, oh wow, yes, that's why this has to be done. It doesn't have to be done. If you want to do it, do it. If you like it and it helps support whatever you're doing, then by all means do it and don't worry about what anybody tells you. Now, on encouraging comb drawing, you have a couple of conditions that must exist. Number one, there needs to be a nectar flow. This can be a nectar flow that came from nature from the environment, or it can be one that you are simulating with a sugar syrup infusion. But one way or another, they're going to have some kind of a nectar flow to be drawing comb. This is typically the scenario where you're going to be using that one-to-one sugar syrup, which will aid in that process. And of course, it's going to need to be some kind of foundation, whether it is an all-plastic frame or a wooden frame with plastic foundation or a wooden frame with wax foundation. One way or another, they're going to have foundation available to them in order to complete part two of this. Now, if it is in the brood space, you guys have heard me mention several times about what I do, and I'm actively doing it in the bee yard right now. I think every one of the colonies out there, except for maybe one, has a frame of undrawn comb, just regular wax foundation sitting in the middle of the brood space. I guarantee it's in all but maybe one of them, and I think one of them has two, because I moved frame up the other day, and I had two up top, two at the bottom, and I now have one in between both of those, getting them to draw both of them out. In the brood space, I recommend doing it one at a time. When it is on a flow like we have right now, like many of you throughout the country or the Northern Hemisphere are having right now, it doesn't take long at all for them to draw the comb up and begin to make that available for using for brood and whatever other resources they may need to use it for. In the honey space, what I will tend to do, if you have just, whether it's a queen excluder and honey above, or whether it's just a space above the brood space that you know they, based on the configuration of your hive and where they are putting brood today, that they are highly likely and it is probable that in that upper space above them at that point is very likely to only be honey. In that case, then that's where you can kind of go with the technique they refer to as checkerboarding. So let's say if you had a space there where directly above where they've been working with the brood, there might be, let's say, three frames right in the middle where they're putting away some nectar and it's, you know, ultimately curing to become honey. You can slide the one frame to the right, the other frame to the left, and then in between the two of those, you just put some wax foundation or, again, whatever type of frame you're using that is your foundation, just put it in between the two of them, let them draw that up. And you can continue doing this checkerboarding technique until the whole thing is drawn out. But a lot of people at any random time of the year just checkerboard everything. And they think, well, I don't understand why this isn't working. Why aren't they drawing this up? You've got to have the flow. And I really don't like doing it in the brood space. So please don't do that in the brood space because they have resources where they need them. They're putting everything exactly where they want it. So if you just drop one frame in the middle, they can kind of, you know, be ladder to the left and be ladder to the right and grab things they might need from an adjacent frame and backfill and do what they need to do. When you completely break everything up, now they have a situation where they have to kind of start going up and around frames sometimes to get what they need. And it becomes a bit more laborious. It's, you know, it's much more moving and walking around time and less time getting things done. Now, again, as a beekeeper, are you going to notice a difference? Maybe not, probably not. You can go in there and randomly mix all the frames up and put them in, you know, some completely random order and come back in a week, week and a half, and everything will be moved around and put back exactly where they want it. So they're going to figure it out. It's just a matter of how many bee hours worth of labor you're going to create for them by putting things where you want them. When in doubt, leave it alone. When you don't know and you're like, oh my God, what do I do? Just leave it alone. I promise you they will find a solution. Just leave them alone. Let them go. Okay. The next one is selecting frames for the split or a nuke. Now, the split is kind of a tiny bit different because we don't really know what size split we might be talking about. This could be a scenario where it's you're taking one colony and you're making four out of it, or you could just be doing a down the middle kind of split and putting about half in one and half in the other. But I would say if you have the ability to do so, to put yourself in the strongest situation possible, and again, your mileage may vary. Different times of year will yield different results. But I would really recommend, just for safety's sake, particularly as you are new and trying to figure things out, just go ahead and plan on a five-frame nuke. If you're going to do a split, plan on at least moving out a total of five frames. And this is really simple. There's nothing scientific here. If you go and ask 10 beekeepers, what do I have in the nuke? You may quite possibly get 10 different answers. The only thing I think you really have to have is you have to have a queen, or you have to be bringing a queen in, or you have to have a queen plan. Right? That's part one. And then you're going to have, I recommend at least two full frames of brood. That's a really critical component, because when you're establishing this brand new colony, every piece of kept brood that is in the hive in those frames, they are going to emerge. They are your new nurse bees, and they are going to raise the next generation of bees as that queen is just laying eggs like mad. Nucleus colonies can become brood factories, and they will just keep laying like crazy. So keep putting the new frames in there. Keep letting that queen fill them up and keep moving them wherever they need to get moved to support your apiary or other projects or other activities, you know, in the bee yard. But if you have at least two frames of capped brood, from there you have, I think you have a lot of latitude. I like having at least one good honey frame or a nectar frame, something that on both sides is really packed out with resources. If you have that third frame, whether it's an all pollen frame or a mostly pollen frame or all brood on one side and a half pollen frame, that's great. Even if you don't have a dedicated pollen frame, which isn't doesn't always happen, as long as there's pollen that is stored, you know, on the brood frames themselves and it's available for feeding to the developing larvae and the next round of bees, that's all you're going to need. They're going to continue getting more from the environment because the flow is on. So again, as a guide, try to get at least two brood frames, one honey frame, and beyond that, mix up the other two, however is best for you. And then after you've done that a couple of times and you see how they recover, you see how quickly they recover, get a little wild next year. Or if you still have time in this season, depending on your resources, next time take two frames, put one, and not even two, take a frame of foundation, just regular wax foundation, one frame that is completely packed with brood and some mixed resources, put the two of them in a two-frame nuke or a three-frame nuke, and just put, again, one single brood frame that's just completely packed out in four or five of these little small nukes with a brand new queen, preferably a mated queen. But if you have a queen cell, that's okay too. She'll go out, get mated, and 10 days later, you got eggs coming and she's making things happen. But you can start cycling those things out, make a little brood factory there too. It's not as easy with the two framers if you're dealing with limited nectar flows and things like that because the clock is ticking. But if you're in an area that has a nice prolonged flow from now through June, July, August, and it just keeps going, by all means, have some fun. Get a little wild and crazy out there in the apiary. All right, everybody, remember that the app is going live at midnight. If you are listening to this right now, the app is available. So check the link for that out in the description. Take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon. I know how intimidating beekeeping can be, especially in those first couple of years, and not knowing what you need, what to do, or where to find help can be downright scary. That's why I created the AI-assisted Beekeeping for Newbies mobile app to be right there with you as you start your beekeeping journey. Load it up with checklists, guides, and one of my favorites, a bunch of queen bee photos to help you get better at locating them during inspections. I created this app to provide you with a single source to help jumpstart your learning and make you a better beekeeper. Go to studio.com/beekeeper. That's studio.com/beekeeper to get started today.